Hello, and welcome to the Military Maker Podcast. We're a group of military guys making the transition from the battlefield to the woodshop, who like to talk about making, running a business, innovating, creating, and whatever else comes to mind. So, you just might learn something here, or you may not, but what do you have to lose? So go ahead, pull up a seat, and join us while we discuss our next mission. But remember, folks, we are vets. Sometimes words slip, so watch your six.
Hey, welcome back to the Military Makers Podcast. This is Sarge, and I got almost the whole crew here except Flash tonight. And we also have a guest, David Darling, the Kilted Boyer. And before we begin the show, we'd like to thank a few people. So go ahead, Jesse. Let's who do we got to thank?
All right. Well, hey, first off, I just want to say, you know, the cool thing about podcast, right, is that it's basically free entertainment for anybody. And what's really, and the reason I bring that up is it brings even more weight to the folks I'm going to mention, because they're under no obligation to pay. They could listen to this podcast free, and we'd be just as thankful. But there's every single download is well appreciated by us. But with that said, as we announced last show, we have a new tier system on Patreon, and we've got two folks who've actually upgraded their tier level. So first we got Adam from Rock Dingo Woodcraft, and he upgraded to tier two, so that, you know, that makes him a damn fine American. And so thank you, Rock Dingo, and definitely go check him out. He's got some pretty great epoxy work. He pours some epoxy into some carvings, and it looks pretty great. So he's supporting us. So go support him. And thanks again, Adam. And then finally, we have our first War Eagle, Drew from Anchor and Ash Woodworking. And again, so he's on tier three, currently our upper tier. With that said, let me take a step back. Nobody took us up on the offer on the Sarge special here, but that's a little disappointing, but we'll get over it. And anyways, Drew from Anchor and Ash, he does a lot of military memorabilia, turns a lot of great pens, makes some pretty cool flags. So please go check him out as well. And so thanks again to those two gentlemen, and thanks to everybody listening now.
Sweet. That is pretty nice, man. And if you want to be part of the crew, go to patreon.com/militarymakers and consider giving us a little donation every month. We really appreciate it. So before we kick it off, I want to recognize a military organization that helps out disabled veterans and veterans basically across the board of all generations, and that's the DAV, Disabled American Veterans. And I tell you what, you wouldn't believe how big this organization is, but they have over 1 million people working as supporters and volunteers helping out veterans throughout the whole United States. And I tell you, it's quite an organization. They're nonprofit, and I'll give you some numbers here and some things that they do. First of all, they're advocates for veterans. All right. So in the last year and a half, they've basically fronted 36 bills to Congress, and they've had 8 pass in the last couple of years to help out veterans. So they're kind of like the NRA in a way. They're out there fighting for our benefits and keeping our benefits and making things better for us as veterans, especially disabled veterans. DAV, they represented over 160 veteran claims in 2020, and which provided about $23 billion. That's right, $23 billion in earned benefits to our veterans in 2020. So that's some of the things due. And I personally have used that service, and it was great. And over the last 5 years, they provided over $4 million to veterans who are affected by natural disasters. They have given up $2.1 million in unemployment benefit relief in the last 5 years. Let's see, they've sponsored 92 job fairs in the last couple of years, and they have gotten 151,000 job offers through those job fairs to veterans. And they also offer free transportation to all veterans, especially wounded veterans. And in year 2020, they drove 675,000 hours, all right, 9.6 million miles, and that equated to 243,000 rides for veterans free of charge. So if you want to learn more about the veterans, go to DAV.org, or you can go check out the History Channel and watch The Battle Never Ends. It's a 1-hour documentary on the history of the DAV. So this great organization, and they're doing their best to do right by those forever change in service. We really appreciate it. Thanks. So having said that, we got a guest here tonight. We got the Kilted Boyer, David Darling. How's it going, David?
Not too bad. All right. Working through the Rona right now.
Oh, you got it too? So does Jeff. Jeff.
Yeah.
Verona Brothers.
Hey, that almost sounds like something like, Happy Days or Laverne and Shirley. That could be a
show. Yeah, we're the late night special.
Yeah.
Late night. Late on Skinamax.
I thought I was going TV Land, but.
Oh, we'll go PG.
Yeah, isn't TV Land with all the old shows, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where I was going.
Look, I'm not going to date myself with all this old TV, so.
You watched it in prime time. It's all good.
So, David, you're a boyer, which is someone who makes boats, right?
Correct.
All right, well, cool, man. So tell us a little about yourself.
Well, so I'm 37, going on 38 here. Been shooting
long walks on the beach.
I do.
Single. Good.
But I've been shooting traditional equipment, longbows and recurve, since I was about 3 years old. So about 35 years now. My dad was never picked up a compound, and I just kind of did that deal, and so threw a longbow in my hand at three, and followed the family tradition, I guess. So just shooting a stick and string, joined the Air National Guard in 2002 here in Michigan. Spent 7 years as a weapons loader on A-10s. We got bracked in 04. So our A-10s actually went to the other side of the state, to Selfridge, because they lost their F-16s. And lobbying and whatnot was able to get our aircraft moved to the other side of the state and left us with no hardware. I ended up becoming a crash rescue firefighter. So like flash there. And did that for 5 years. That really kind of sucked the soul out of me, I hate to say, of the military side of things. And I got out in 2014. And as a matter of fact, we're about 2 weeks and I'd qualify for retirement if I'd stayed in. But anyhow, so became a paramedic, following in the fire side of things, did the paramedicine and did that for 9 years as an EMS, one as an EMT, two, eight as a paramedic. And decided I didn't want to do that anymore. That it was really starting to affect my mental health and just whatnot. And the traditional art, it's always been an extreme passion of mine, and had a lot of desire to learn how to build bows. And so 3 years ago, there was a boyer that was going out of business due to health reasons, and I got a hold of him, he was looking for somebody to buy his equipment, and I got a hold of him and found out what he wanted for it. I couldn't say no to the price, and a week later I flew out to Salt Lake City, drove a Penske truck up to his place, loaded all the equipment, wood, whatnot, into the truck, and drove it home back to Michigan. So it's kind of me in a nutshell, outside of, married, six kids, just busier than all get out.
Yeah, six kids. I'd make anybody busy right there, man. I only got two, and my head is falling off at the time. So Jesse's got you got three, don't you, Jesse?
Plus a son. So kind of 3.2,
Right, well, you got three or four. What is it?
Four. I got four, Sarge.
Oh, yeah. See, he's busy too, man.
Yeah. I'm not busy. So how'd you find a guy out in Salt Lake selling all that equipment from out in Michigan?
Actually, a Facebook group called the Boyer's Corner. I'd been following it for a while, and he just posted up there. He's like, hey, I've got all these tools and some couple of forms and an oven, and all essentially just took a bunch of pictures and said, contact me for info. And it was one of those like, do I do it? I called my dad and I was like, what do you think he's gonna want for this? And my dad's like, yeah, he's probably gonna want a pretty high number. And I was actually on shift, and I talked to my partner. I was like, what do you think about this? I mean, like, this is a really good way for me to get into the, cause I've been talking about it for 2 or 3 years, and my partners were probably getting sick of hearing that. And I was like, what do you think? And he's like, dude, what's the worst you can say? Like, it's out of your price range. Just find out what he wants for it. And so, yeah, I messaged him, and he came back with a number that I could not refuse. So I was like, yep, we're sold. Booked a one-way flight that night, and then got the rental truck lined up in a hotel room, and got a buddy to fly out with me and to share the drive back, because it's about 20 hours from Salt Lake. But yeah, it was the guy I ended up getting it from. He came down with Meniere's disease, and so he just couldn't be around the loud noises.
Hey, Sarge, you're on mute, brother. Sarge.
I see his lips moving.
He's cracking himself up right now. He's told a great story.
Oh my god! I go on Facebook all the time, Marketplace, trying to find people who are selling out their shops. That way, you never know. You might have one of those tools I've been looking for.
Dude, I see that stuff everywhere. I never get that lucky.
Yeah, sometimes it's one of those, like, because I've seen other guys that are selling like Boyer supplies type stuff, and they always want, I mean, they want an arm and a leg for it. And like I said, my dad, when I asked my dad, he gave me a number that was 6-7 times higher than what I bought it for.
Can you be more specific on that? I'm just interested to know how much that stuff costs. I have no idea.
If you bought it new right now, if you bought it brand new right now, what kind of number are we looking
at? If I bought everything brand new, so I got a Grizzly DLX 14-inch bandsaw, Grizzly baby drum sander, Grizzly 6x84 edge sander, Rikon 1.5 horse dust collector. Think that's it for the tools. Oh, and a 25-gallon compressor. I paid what those tools were worth new, and then I got everything else for free. So about $3,000.
But you said that you had to have an oven and are some of the specialty stuff that you have to get to do that?
Honestly, an oven is nothing but a plywood box with a lot of guys use light bulbs for their heating elements. I'm actually using reptile cage infrared heaters. So I'm running the new oven that I built is I got 650 watt infrared heaters in there. So
is there advantage to that infrared heat?
I think it creates less hot spots. That, and they last longer than the light bulbs. You know, incandescent light bulbs go out pretty quick, especially when you're dealing with, you know, 120 to 150 watt bulbs. So, I've been running on a PDI controller now. So, I just dial in my temp and it'll keep it within a tenth of a degree.
The ATF ever come knocking thinking you're growing weed or anything like that?
No.
No. Plus he's making bows.
That's my neighbor.
Making firearms.
You must have some really chilled neighbors.
He actually, Michigan has, we're recreational now, Colorado. Yeah. But even before that, you could grow it. We had the medicinal laws or whatever. And you could grow for medicinal patients. He doesn't actually smoke. He just grows it. And he's had it through license through people that actually need it medicinally. So
don't get high on your own supply.
That's right.
That's smoking your own profits though, man.
Yeah. Isn't that any immortal words of Dr. Dre?
Don't get high on your own supply. We're damn you.
So you know,
go ahead, Sarge.
No, I'm good.
What do you want? Don't even let
me. You got to get it out before you forget. You got out that Alzheimer's shit.
I'm good. Don't worry about it.
I think we're all done. It's your turn.
We're just going to make fun of Sarge. So
okay. Yeah.
Nothing to add at all.
I do have something. So, you know, you're a Boyer. You know, Jesse here, he makes beer tap handles and other type of furniture and stuff like that. Flash, he makes all kinds of novelty items such as maps and you name it. Wade here, phenomenal epoxy guru over here. I mean, if you ever follow him, he's got some pretty cool stuff on his feed. Uh-huh. And then you got Mills up here. You know, he's making on his own, man. He's full-time woodworker now, man. I mean, making his own way, you know. And that brings us to the subject of, you know, do you consider yourself a maker?
Do I? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I think so. You know, I'm making something, right?
All right, there you go.
You didn't mention Jesse, dude. Is he not a maker?
Yeah, you said beer tap.
Yeah, he's a beer tap. Beer
tap furniture. I didn't know where he was going with that. I was like, why is he comparing beer taps with bows? Yeah. I had no idea where that was going, but
that's par for the course.
Yeah. I need a drink.
Get a drink.
Well, we are unscripted, so. But, you know, it's Jesse was saying that he was thinking about, you know, what makes us, you know, what is a maker and what's a military maker, you know. It's, and I thought that was pretty, that encompasses a lot of stuff. So, I mean, as far as you go, Jesse, I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, look, I'm not like, I don't know the origin of the word maker as it pertains to the maker community, right? Like, I think that's a pretty weak word for what we all are. Personally, I'm not so arrogant to think that I'm going to change like the maker community and they're going to be like, yeah, the word maker sucks, but it does. The word maker sucks.
Here we go with more mean emails and DMs and stuff after you're dancing with tools.
Well, yeah, you know, whatever. I could be the villain here. That's okay. I think everybody here is more, I think, craftsman, or I just think there's better words than maker. Cause I think to me, maker is like the equivalent of a cook. And if you're a chef, I got to think you're going to hate the word cook, right? Like, we could all follow a recipe, but you just take it to that next level, the chef level. And you know, to bring in the bow work, man, like looking at your bows, I mean, that is next level craftsmanship. You're not making bows. You're crafting something original and something great. That's not, I don't know. Again, I don't think I'm going to change the maker community. I don't know the origin of where that came from. I just wish somebody would have been a little more creative.
I kind of agree with you on that, because it's kind of like tiers in Patreon. Like, you have your maker, they just make something, whether it be a 2x4 table for their nightstand or whatever. Then you have your craftsman. Like you said, the craftsman has a better eye for fine details and makes something that is more of it's a usable item, but it's a work of art as well. So, like, shit, I'd say all of us. I mean, majority of the people that I know that consider themselves makers are craftsmen. They are fine-tuned. Their machines are fine-tuned. They have very, like, attention, like, strict attention to detail. It's, maker is a very loose word, I guess you could say.
Yes, it's a loose word, but I think if you look at it, it's kind of a category. You know, if you look at like genus, species, that kind of deal, you know, you can get as broad as you want, you can get as narrow as you want. But I think, and while I agree with you guys, I also think that, you know, you can kind of throw everybody into that group, because otherwise it's like, well, this maker's a boyer, this maker just does furniture, this, you know, just this guy just does cabinets or whatever. And yes, you're all fine detail and everything else, but when it comes down together, maybe craftsman would be a better term, but I think like craftsmanship has often been termed with woodworking versus, you know, like being a knife maker, you know, or running a forge where that's being a maker as well, right? So, you know, while you can have all that, I think that the maker is the loose term, and then you can divvy it up all you want down to the fine nitty gritty. Yeah. That's my opinion. Take it.
I agree with you. I just think it undercuts the skill level that so many of y'all have, you know, like to say that you're a maker. I just don't think it gives you the value that you necessarily earned and deserve.
I hear maker, I think I'm kind of with you on that, Jesse. When I hear maker, I think of like a third grader making a house out of popsicle sticks. Like, it's a loosely thrown together something
would call a third grader making a house out of popsicle sticks a maker. Oh, look at that maker.
They're making
over there.
A house.
That kid's a maker. Nobody would do that.
Future maker of America, right there. Is that a new high school club? He's gonna be FMOA.
You know, my kid did that. I called him an artist. So.
Listen, and you know, the name maker, I think it rolls off the tongue. Like, you got military makers too, right? I mean, the military craftsman, that would just sound stupid. I don't know.
I don't know. When my kid was a baby, he made a number two. Is he a maker?
I think that qualifies all of us.
Some of us are closer to diapers again than others, but
I'm going to make a prediction right here, right now. I'm going to predict that when we wake up in the morning, Sarge's new IG handle is going to be Sergeant Craftsman.
I do own the domain,
Sergeant Craftsman.
I mean, it's in his IG handle, maker. Love you, Sarge. You know,
don't go with anything.
No,
man. That's what it is.
Seriously.
Oh, Sarge makes houses out of popsicle sticks. Sorry, Sarge.
He engraves the cool details on his laser engraver now. So hey, it's okay.
Listen. I look at it as more of a broad thing, okay? Because if you look at the quotations, maker community, you know, that encompasses like people who make tumblers. You know, they do the epoxy on the tumblers, or you know, you got these people who make the laser engravings, or you know, all that kind of, all those type of things that most people would sit back, or 3D printers. You know, you got people doing really killer stuff on 3D printers and they're considered makers. Would you call that a craftsman? Would that be a craftsman?
Someone who does 3D printing?
Because they call it a coder. I don't know if I call it.
Nope, we got a rant coming up. Stop it.
The fucking epoxy, like I follow all those group shit, Facebook and, you know, on Instagram or whatever, I guess, but the fucking epoxy people that pour the epoxy in the mold and that's all they do. They just take it out of the mold and they fucking sell it. So they literally mix two chemicals together. Half the time it's not even pigments, it's fucking clear, and they put all their little knickknacks and their trash in there and then they fucking take it out of the mold and they sell it to people, dude. And they think that they're this fucking makers or whatever, and it's I just hate it. It like destroys the community for me. But okay,
so Jesse and Wade are both going to be getting bad DMs.
Good. I hope they fucking all do.
Nothing new here. Nothing
Wait, I had a funny feeling as soon as the word epoxy came up.
I saw his face. His whole demeanor changed.
We're going to get the rant, man. We're going to get the rant.
When you said epoxy on cups, he went.
I got rants for days on that. For days.
But hey, we do. I mean, we have to address something, right? We're the military makers. So even though at least two of us, potentially three or more, have said that we disagree with the word maker a little bit, we're still the military makers, right? And like you said, Wade, it does flow off tongue. David, like you said, it's all encompassing for anybody. Like, we're not exclusionary, you know, anybody who is crafting anything. But I think the important part in our title is the military piece, right? Because that's really what sets us all apart. And I guess my question for everybody, like, do you feel like your military experience, I mean, being around the variety of people that we've been around, the variety of experiences that we've all had, how does that go into our quote unquote making of things? You know, I mean, it's got to help, but I mean, just the diversity of experience.
I think so. I mean, at least coming from the Air Force side of things, I mean, attention to detail was drilled in us from the first day we stepped off the bus at LAC, you know, and you know, and then my first 7 years working in the weapons side of the house on the A-10, you know, I'm dealing with high explosives on a daily basis. I mean, much like being a pilot, like if you screw something up, you could kill somebody. Whether it's, you know, whether I was working with Willie Pete's or, you know, HE or whatever it may be, you know, you kill somebody, you can hurt somebody, and attention to detail is critical. And I think that for me, you know, as a warrior, the attention to detail, I try and put that into everything that I do. In my current job, you know, when I'm not doing this or raising kids, you know, I work part-time doing kind of general construction stuff. And the guy I work for, Rod, I know he gets frustrated with me because he's very much just, you know, make it fit and, you know, we can get it done. And I'm very detail oriented. Like I want it to that like 32nd, 64th of an inch. And he's like, we can have an eighth of an inch. And I think that for me, at least, the attention to detail portion that was ingrained in me through the military has really carried over into this.
I agree with that. I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, I think that's what kind of separates us from the normal maker is the attention to detail. Because like you said, it's instilled to you or into you day one. It is from very first day to the last day you're in, attention to detail. Because like you said, if you don't pay attention to those things, people get hurt or die. And even like with me building furniture, people can get hurt if I don't pay attention to things. People can sit on a two-story bunk bed and crash down like the movie Brother or Step Brothers and blood everywhere. I don't need that. So I think that's where the military kind of separates us from everybody else is that attention to detail.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that other woodworkers out there don't have the attention to detail, but I think it's more instilled in our minds. It's not an afterthought. It's more forethought.
Absolutely. I think that it's one of those things, like you said, not afterthought, forethought. And I think that that's one of the differences where when you see military, you know, or vets that are making stuff, you can typically expect that their craftsmanship is going to be top notch. I mean, it's a painting with a broad brush, but, you know, they're going to be your outliers. But in general, every vet that I've seen that's making something, their quality is, you know, at the top.
Yeah, they'd never ship out something that they wouldn't buy themselves, right? Like, it's going to be top. notch, like you said.
I mean, all of us, I'm sure, have dealt with mil-spec and the crummy quality that comes with that title. So I think we've all dealt with crappy quality, and we don't want to be the face of that, like all the equipment that we've ever used. So yeah, we want to make sure our quality is above that and to our expectations. So like you said, throughout the whole project, you can see the detail going into people's work, especially military members or veterans or what have you, prior service. You can see throughout the project rather than the final product having that fine detail, because we pay attention through the whole course of the deal.
Right. You can only speak for the Army guys as far as the equipment we've ever used.
Oh yeah, Air Force, I'm sorry, you guys get like the cool stuff.
Yeah. He got issued an iPad and basic training.
Right.
It was a bit before that time, but okay.
Hey, no, man. That was right when they first came out is when...
Oh, two.
It was the iPhone 1. What are we on, like 11 now or something?
Shit, they hadn't even come out with the 13. iPod when I was in basic.
I know. I'm just... quit wrecking my joke, man.
Not as old as Sarge, but
none of us are.
I'm pretty sure when I reported to the submarine, I had a CD, like the CD walk. I'm pretty sure.
I bought a CD Walkman after, like, at the end of basic when I was getting ready to leave, you know, that like 2 or 3 days before you head off to tech school, like you got to go to the BX. I bought a CD Walkman and a couple of CDs because I didn't have anything when I was down.
I definitely got you. I actually had a cassette Walkman, and
you had an 8-track Walkman. I'm not even sure if they make those.
It got confiscated. He just walked around with a
record player,
and I didn't see it until I finished AIT.
I don't know, him and his Dr. Dre reference. I think he probably carried boombox on his shoulder when he stepped out there.
No, I could never afford a boombox, man. Those things were expensive, man, and those D-cell batteries. But you know, I think another thing is, I think a lot of military people are very goal orientated. Like they see a target and, you know, they're hell bent on going for it a lot of times, but also being able to adapt, you know, just, I think I see a lot of these military guys on the YouTube and Instagram. And they always come up with these really, you know, interesting ways to do something, you know, it's like, and I think that's one aspect of the whole military background thing. Okay. Jeff, I hear you looking down there, like want to say something, man. Flash.
I didn't catch it. What word did he say?
It's in the chat.
Oh,
I hate when people say goal orientated. Hey, I'm goal orientated. I'm like, what the hell does that mean? I mean, goal oriented. We always got to pick on Sarge. I don't have anything else to add to this. I've wanted to hear you guys' input first, and mine's no different. The first thing I thought of was attention to detail, and a couple of you have already alluded to it. And it's not to say that non-veteran woodworkers or whoever makers don't have attention to detail. But that's the first place my mind went. I've burnt more projects that I couldn't deliver to somebody because I wasn't satisfied with the quality than I care to admit. These guys know really well. I actually would probably consider myself a maker as opposed to a craftsman. The things I make, I'm just not that skilled of a woodworker. So
come on, man.
I'm certainly not mad about being a maker. I've got a CNC machine, which is automated. I've got a laser engraver, which is automated. Come on, man. Like, I don't.
It takes skill to use that just because you're not fucking rolling around like cavemen anymore. I'm a fucking woodworker. I only use this and that. Yeah. Sorry, I fucking adapted. I mean,
yeah, go out and hit the go button on your CNC right now and see what happens.
Yeah, exactly.
Just nothing. Just go hit the button.
Nothing.
Exactly.
You press a button. And it fucking prints this out for you. Yeah, that's not how it works, but good job.
Yeah, but Jeff,
sorry, Flash, you couldn't afford a fucking CNC, bitch.
Coming up with the design and all that stuff like that, and coming up with files that you're actually going to use on your machine, right there, that's art. You know, that actually takes a lot to accomplish.
Etsy is my friend.
Oh, come on.
Well, I can see where Flash is coming, but this goes back to the, you know, where I said earlier, where I think that maker is kind of that, it's that broad stroke. In the catch-all, where, you know, the attention to detail with his coding ability or whatever enabled in being able to work the CNC and the laser, it puts him in that craftsman level. But to say, like, craftsman, maker, what, you know, like, it's going to be, there's, I'm a boyer, you're a woodworker, you're a coder, you're, you know, CNC operators, you know, that was my first job in high school. Like, that I worked in a CNC shop in the summertime. The guys that were coding those CNCs are some of the smartest men I ever met. And the ability to have that attention to detail and to be able to do that is a craft in and of itself. So yeah. I wouldn't take anything away from what you do, Flash. But I understand where you're coming from, and the not wanting to call yourself a craftsman and just, you know, calling yourself a maker type deal. But
I see so many really awesome projects out there on the IG. I mean, even your bows, I mean, stuff like that, to me, that's true craftsmanship, in my opinion. And guys who build extravagant furniture, you know, nicely detailed, well built, well thought out furniture, things like that, that to me is more of a craftsman. I mean,
and a woodworker.
I see what you're saying too. I usually sell myself short, but I do think there's a difference between what I do in my little wood shop and what some of you guys do and others.
Well, how about this though, right? So to me, the big difference is everybody could be craftsmen or makers or whatever. To me, I mean, you have the person who created the idea, right? And that's the artist. That's the visionary, whatever pedestal you want to put that person on. And everybody else who's kind of copying that are the makers or the craftsmen or whatever. But it's like you said, you're a fan of, you know, you go to Etsy. Well, somebody had to do that 3D model, right? Now, David, I'm not big in the Boyer community, but I have to believe that what you're doing, that is, I mean, you can call yourself a maker, but that's artistry, that's creativity, that's innovation. I mean, it's all these other words. And that's my problem with the word maker, is I don't know if it encompasses those words on the level that I would hope they could, if that makes any sense.
No, I get it.
But it's, I mean, enough of that. We can beat this down all day. I just, let's just all agree that veterans are better than everybody else.
And, cheers.
And have another beer. That's right.
I have to agree with that.
I got to reiterate that I'm not a woodworker by any, because I don't want to send anybody off with what I've said. I don't claim to be one or even a craftsman. I mean, my business card says custom wood and resin project. So to me, that's, you know, I mean, even Flash too, like he can create something custom to somebody that's not, you know, something you can buy off fucking Amazon. Made in the USA, you know, handmade by a veteran in some sense. I mean, he's still got to put his hands on it. We've talked about this before, sanding and finishing. And so there's just so much that goes into it. And I mean, some people probably get mad that you take that title, but I think that's probably why people take that maker title, right? Because this is all encompassing. And I'm going to go get that drink that you told me.
All right, Sarge, what's next?
What's next? Well, you know, we talked about having like a little segment on the show. Now, we're not all going to have something to input on this particular segment. I think it could be something that could be fun or even serious, or, you know, it could be a serious conversation or it could be a fun conversation. But I like for us to, like, every time we have a show, is to bring something that we fucked up on since our last show. Like, it could be something that you did in the shop. It could be something you did in your life with your relationships, or even with, you know, I mean, anything. And how did you handle it? And what did you do to fix it? Now, I didn't really think about that this much this last 2 weeks. And this is something I like to implement. So anybody got something they want to share with us as far as that goes?
I do. I'll start off.
Yeah, Flash. I knew it, baby. Woo!
A model of perfection right here. I don't believe it.
You know, I'm screwing stuff up in the shop. So you guys probably remember, I've got a good buddy who has a real successful high chair, toddler chair business in my area. And about a year ago, he approached me to use my CNC machine to make his trays, you know, just the trays that go on a high chair, the food goes on or whatever. He didn't really have a way to get that done. Started watching some of my videos on IG. He's like, man, do you think you can make a high chair tray? I'm like, well, I'm sure I could. We could agree on, you know, the settings and all that. Sure. So anyway, he brought another batch over the other day. And so what he uses, of course, is clean pine, you know, good clear pine. You know how expensive that stuff is right now. Anyway, I cycle them all through on my CNC machine. And there's some times where, you know, each tray, as I'm hollowing out the top a little bit, I only go down just a fraction of an inch. But when I'm doing that, it's probably about a 20-minute process. So there's times I'll hop inside, grab a drink, let the dog out, whatever, go back out. So I did. Went back into the garage. Oh, man, it was I was cutting the trays out at this point. So I was using a quarter-inch end mill bit that I had in. And part of of part of the edge of one of the trays as it was almost cut all the way through, broke loose and basically got into the bit, caused the bit to go across the tray. And so when I'm doing these, like, I'm probably doing about 30 at a time, you know, 30 in a row. So long story short, I ended up trashing two of them. So that leads, of course, to a trip to the hardwood store, buying another, you know, I got to replace it. So I think I bought a six footer, 1x12, 6 foot. I swear that some buck was $38. I mean, seriously, like, holy smokes, a 6 foot, 1x12, like $38. So, you know, it's just those types of things that just kind of eat into your profit. It's like, damn. But I mean, even with a CNC machine, even with an automated machine, stuff happens. No, you guys have seen it too. So that's my story for last.
That's good. So it costs you a little money though, huh?
Absolutely. Yeah. Cuts into the profit. I mean, I'm making roughly, I think, $9 on each tray is what I usually charge him, something like that. Yeah. But again, when I go out and I got to pay $38 or $40 for a board.
Yeah, that's like four trays right there.
Like four or five trays. So I mean, you know, stuff happens. That's part of it. But
risky business. Hey, as soon as you said, I went out, got the dog, I was like, oh, I know where this is going already.
Yeah.
See it coming.
Yep. Who else? Somebody share. Somebody mess something up.
Okay. So myself, I mess up quite a bit. And I tell you what, it probably costs more money than I like to admit. But for instance, like we were talking about military, being military makers, attention to detail. Well, I have a branding iron, and I made a stool. I was getting ready to ship it off, and I went ahead and branded it. And the brand didn't come out the way I liked it. It was too much burn, and I couldn't get it fixed. And I ended up doing a whole nother stool because I didn't want to send that stool out with that fucked up brand on it. That's so now I got an extra stool sitting in my house that I can't sell because I screwed up the brand on it. You go through all that crap to put the wrong brand to, you know,
it's already assembled.
It's already assembled. It's already assembled.
Oh, I was gonna say your flat pack, you just take that piece.
I gotta know, David, it doesn't have to be since last week, but have you had any glorious things go wrong with a bow, especially under tension?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Prototyping my first recurves was kind of a pain. Recurves because of the extra curve, you know, obviously the reflex and the tips of the limbs, they get twisty the thinner you go. And the first one I did let go, like it delaminated. So I was talking to kind of one of my mentors, Jerry Brum, who used to own Great Northern Bow Hunting. He had actually spent a little bit of time in his shop, and I've known him since I was knee high to a grasshopper. Anyway, he's like, hey, I asked him if he had any input, and he's like, well, you didn't see me make any recurves in the shop, so why don't you come over to the shop? And it was after he'd actually sold the business to his son. And he's like, we'll go over to Bobby's, and I'll walk you through how I, you know, dynamically tiller a recurve. And so I laid up another one, and I had the profile put on and everything else that I was using for my limb profile, which, you know, is your kind of the profile limb as you're looking at it from the front, how it tapers and everything. And I get there and we start going through everything, and I cut the excess off, and he goes to put the tillering blocks on it. He's kind of walking me through what he's doing. He puts tillering blocks on it, and the limbs are starting to twist a little bit, and he's trying to adjust it, and he gets it. He puts it on a kind of a pulley system to get it drawn, like as you're, you know, like you'd be drawing the bow, and to see how the limbs are coming up, because you don't want them twisting dynamically as you're going through the draw cycle. You want it to come out, you know, come square. And he gets about, I don't know, 10, 12 inches from brace, maybe not even that far. And it just unloads. The limbs twist, tillering blocks come off, bow delaminates. It actually ended up, Jerry's, I think he's close to 80 now, but it, you know, this is 2 or 3 years ago, so mid 70s. Anyway, it ends up hitting his arm. He ends up with a big skin tear. He's got a scar from it now. He's bleeding all over the place. So I, like early on, you know, trying to prototype stuff, that was a big pain. I've had a couple other bows that I didn't mark clearly enough when I put them in the form, and I've become so so paranoid about doing this. I actually ended up after it bow came out of the form, I built it upside down. Like I put the shelf on the what would normally be the lower end of the riser. I did that I think twice. In the bows, they look kind of funny. They shoot fine, but they just look weird. And I couldn't figure out. I'm like, why the hell is this? Like tiller is way off on this. And I'm looking at it, I'm like, son of a gun. You know, it's it. But had to cut a couple bows in half because of that.
So you actually had the shelf in the wrong location.
Yeah, and the shelf was on the bottom. Like if the way that because they're not. I actually got a riser block here off of one of the bows that it would have happened to. And you can see like this is the top and it's a lot longer in the fade out and in the ramp. The lower side is, and I actually cut the shelf on this side versus on this side. So it ended up upside down like this. They shoot, they perform, but it's not aesthetically pleasing.
I'm sure that develops a serious pissed off moment right there.
Yeah. You know, well, but you know, depending on the woods, you know, the wood that you put in the riser, I mean, I use a lot of exotics, you know, so like you're 1x12x6 for $40, you know, there's some stuff that I buy that, you know, is a 24 inch turning block. That's $40, you know, 2x2x24. That's 40. Depending on what it is. I mean, I think one of them was Padauk, so it was relatively inexpensive. So I think I had about $20 into the riser. That's fiberglass is expensive these days, and it's going up. I'm at about $40 in fiberglass, and about $40 to $50 in fiberglass in a bow. And when you end up having to cut something up, you know, I'm losing $150 to $200.
Oh, I can relate to that.
Luckily, like I run Red Elm for all my cores. So, you know, the core lamination material and that's relatively inexpensive. I was getting that for about $350 a board foot, but I don't know if that's going to go up now or not, but I've still
it's all going up.
Yeah. You know, my neighbor that I was telling you guys about earlier, he actually runs a sawmill and does a lot of custom stuff, tables and whatnot. I don't know if he does chairs, but he's a hell of a woodworker, but he does timber cutting and runs his own sawmill. And he's who I'm going to start getting my Red Elm from now. I had been getting it from another friend of mine, but he's out and not cutting anymore. So,
Wade here, he's got a lumber mill too.
Yep. I saw that.
I'm still waiting on the friendly slabs. Huh? Are they in the mail?
Yeah, slabs in the mail. That's right.
Yeah.
Hey, on Facebook Marketplace, all those wood sellers are like, you know, they offer shipping. It's like, you're not going to ship that. Who's going to pay for shipping on a slab, man?
A $500 slab and then it costs $800 to ship it.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I've seen I'm gonna try something here. I've seen somebody selling like charcuterie board, freaking just blanks, I guess you would call them, and they're just little sections of fucking, you know, whatever, and they sell like packs of five for like $150, and I'm like, dude, I could do that all day, and they ship those out. I mean, probably be $20 to $40, but I mean, the wood's nothing if you got it. So
yeah,
I'm gonna try that too. But
you know, and I don't know. I know, well, so I've sold with all the wood that I got when I bought everything, I had a bunch of Pacific yew and Osage, and I sold a half a dozen yew staves, chunks of yew. They were 8 foot long. It was only $110 to ship them UPS. You know, I packaged them myself and they came and picked them up. I don't know if that's weight, length, whatever, but you know, yeah. Some guys may, you know, if it's good wood and it looks all right.
Well, I think we could all agree there's no such thing as free shipping, right? Like they may say it's free shipping, but the thing costs twice as much as it's supposed to cost, right?
Right. Yeah. Unless it's Amazon and then they buy it for half the price anyway.
So, I put the custom sawmill lumber on Facebook, man, and it's so fucking annoying just having people message me and be like, do you have a piece of walnut that's fucking 2 inches and exactly this wide? And I'm like, I don't know, man. Like, I probably could cut one. And then they just like, well, how much would it be? And I'm like, I don't know. It's just super annoying.
You don't need to do that custom cut shit. Just build up stock.
Yeah. I mean, what am I supposed to do? Find a log that's fucking 24 inches wide or whatever?
If they got a tree that's 30 inches, so you can get that 24 inch wide.
I would just say $40 for custom sizing.
I can't even do it. I'd have to get almost, you know, a different log every single time for some of the stuff they're asking for. And people want pieces of walnut that are like 24 inches and above. And I'm like, that would cost you a fucking, if I had a piece of walnut that was 3 foot long, that would cost you hundreds of dollars.
Just laminate a bunch of smaller pieces.
Yeah. They think that they're getting fucking,
I don't know. Well, but they, you know, it's, they don't have bar clamps or pipe clamps. And they don't have everything to laminate it. You know, it's
yeah. They want that slab, throw some hairpin legs on it, and sell it for $8,000.
Yep. Hey man, hairpin legs are where it's at.
So I do have to tell you guys, this is going to be an unsolicited call out to somebody because I wasn't expecting this, but I had my first appointment at the VA hospital yesterday as the retired group, you know, and after the appointment, I went to a sawmill, and no kidding, it was probably the best surprise in terms of sawmills I've ever seen. The selection of wood, the quality of wood, the prices were decent, but the reason I bring it up, and it's called Jensen's Hardwoods. It was like a 32-year-old Air Force vet, right, who owns it. It was his dad's company that he took over, but he's expanded it tremendously since he's took it over. And it didn't surprise me at all that a veteran owned it. You know, it was super high quality, super awesome. Jensen's Hardwood in Walla Walla, Washington. You know, not that very many people are there, but I just thought of it now. The kid deserves a call out. He's running an outstanding business, and I can't wait to give him some of my money.
Oh yeah,
that's awesome.
I just got a new hardwood supplier myself there, Jesse. I think I bought about 75 board feet of Rift Sawn and Quarter Sawn White Oak. Paid $5.50 a board foot.
It's expensive firewood, Sarge.
Hey, I don't know. Have you priced White Oak lately? It's not cheap, man, especially Quarter Sawn. But these boards are like 14 inches wide. They're really nice, beautiful. And I got a project for them already lined up for my daughter. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. But unfortunately, I have to drive 100 miles because I can't touch White Oak here around me within 100 miles for less than, I wouldn't say 100, within 50 miles for less than $8-$9 a board foot.
Yeah.
And that's just plain, just flat sawn White Oak. That's not quarter sawn or anything.
I was just looking at the prices of the place I go for White Oak. Flat sawn for 8-quarter White Oak, where'd it go? Yeah, over $9 a board foot.
Yeah, I'm telling you, these small operations right now, that's where to get it now. And they have a kiln too. They even have their own kiln. It's a pretty sweet little operation.
Rift sawn's close to $11 a board foot.
Yeah. Shit. So you said you use a lot of exotics there?
Yeah.
Yep. Shoot. Just kind of whatever fits your vision at the time, or is there certain woods that have certain qualities that
I use a lot of zebra wood, cocobolo, babinga, padauk. I'm trying to think what I've got. I'm looking down here. Patagonian rosewood. That's not too exotic, but it's exotic enough.
It is pretty, though.
It is. I love the way it darkens up. As a matter of fact, first bow that I built myself, that riser is Patagonian rosewood, and it is stinking beautiful. Yeah. Some domestics. Myrtle has become really big in the traditional community in the last few years. I guess last 10 to 15 anyway. So I've been doing some myrtle. I don't know what my affinity towards people from Hawaii is, but I've got like three amazing friends that are all Hawaiian. And so I've kind of picked up an affinity towards Hawaiian hardwoods, so like koa, mango, eucalyptus robusta. trying to think what else. Wenga or wenge. I don't know how the hell you say it.
What about monkey pod? Can you use monkey pod?
I've used monkey pod.
That koa is that protected wood, didn't it, in Hawaii, where you can only get it from down trees.
Yep. And yeah. So the price per board foot's pretty high on that. Mm-hmm. Ebony's, like Gaboon ebony is about $200 a board foot right now. Cocobolo is between cocobolo. We can't import anymore, so we're kind of stuck with what we have, and that price per board foot's up to, I think, 160 to 200 a board foot on that. I'm trying to think what else I've got here. I'm looking down.
How much does Cocobolo stain?
How much does it stain?
No. How much is the Minwax Cocobolo color stain?
He's like, you fucking idiot. What are you talking about? Staining Cocobolo. Yeah.
No.
$15 for Minwax. What he wants.
No. Yeah, you know what? You could stain. The problem for, like, the problem for a Boyer is that I can't just stain the outside of it. because then you risk, you know, like you have to, whatever you're using, because I have to take so much away. You know, like most of my forms are 1¾ wide, and at the end they're 1⅛ to 1¼, depending on the bow. So, and then because of the footed risers or the flared risers that I do with the, you know, the crazy lines through them where you're matching a couple different woods. Like if I tried to stain something, it would never work out. But when I do use, like I've got ambrosia maple that's been stabilized and dyed. That's, you know, like I've got some of that. But shit, I'm trying to think, the last chunk, last order of that I got in was like $80 a chunk, you know, which was 2x3x20, you know, $80 a piece, you know. But, you know, it's take the cost of the wood, then you take the cost of the resin or the epoxy and the dyes and the time, and you have to add that all up and you get what you get.
Yeah. You know, there's no way on God's green earth you'd know this about me, but I've been known to chase a whitetail too in my time.
yeah, no.
I just brought that up to lead into this. So obviously I'm a big compound user. I've never used traditional archery, really for no reason other than I just haven't. But having you on has certainly given me a renewed interest in looking into it. I have a good friend about two exits down the highway who also does traditional archery. I don't know that he builds so much, but he's big in using it, hunting with it. And I don't know that he owns a compound anymore. So he certainly made that transition and loves the challenge. And he's got one, I think he's named Black Beauty or something. He names them. And it's just pretty neat to watch his Facebook posts.
All that that's pretty common. I mean, that's an option or not even an option. It's just, you know, do you have a name that you'd like for your bow or an inscription? Because, you know, a lot of guys, you know, the last custom bow that I had built was in 2003. It was 2002. It was right after I met my to-be wife. And I knew that it was going to happen. You know, I knew she and I would be together forever. And when I had that built, you know, I wanted it named KD. Her name's Catherine with a K and my name's David. You know, it like KD sounds like Katie, which she goes by, and Catherine and David type deal. And that bow means the world to me, and I would never let that bow go. And anyway, but I guess the point of the story is that, like, a lot of guys put something on their bows that means something to them.
Yeah. I noticed several of your bows, maybe they all do, kind of have, what is it, KBW on them?
Yep.
Filtered bow work. Yeah, is that your signature?
Yeah. Kalamazoo bow works. Yeah. The early bows had the KBW on the belly side of the limb, which is the side of the limb that faces you, kind of belly to belly. I always say it's like you're dancing with your bow. But since the last, I think, year and a half, maybe 2 years, I've transitioned from writing on the belly side of the limb to just putting it on the side of the riser. And it was tough to get Kalamazoo bow works on a 1-inch slice of limb. So I actually can get Kalamazoo bow works on the side of the riser. So
educate me real quick on poundage, right? We compounds, we talk draw weight, things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, how is that incorporated in a traditional bow? Is it the stiffness of the limbs, or is there something else?
So are they all when you're talking how we like with poundage, like I measure it the same AMO spec that a compound would. So at 28 inches, it's going to be, you know, 50 pounds or whatever. So, right. You know, minus your let off on a compound, you know, if you didn't have to let off on a compound, it'd be 50 at 28. Mm-hmm. But I adjust that based on, I can adjust it two ways. You can adjust it through limb width or thickness. But once you have a design set up, you know, your limb width is your limb width in your design. Mm-hmm. So you adjust that through stack height, and stack is your thickness. So for me, it's about 25 thousandths of thickness is equal to about 5. So, you know, when we talk attention to detail, you know, kind of rolling way back there, in the Boyer world, I work in thousandths of an inch, you know, so I don't have a lot of room for error. You know, a couple thousandths can throw something off of quite a bit.
Well, I'm kind of intrigued too. So from start to finish, you probably ask this all the time, from start to finish, what would it take you to throw a bow together? If you worked on it, let's just say 8 hours a day, ballpark.
Hands-on time, I have about 8 hours into a standard risered bow.
Okay.
When we start doing the footed or flared risers, that really starts to increase the time. There's a lot of guys that use jigs and whatnot to make it, to get everything matched up. I haven't invested the time to make jigs yet. So everything I do is hand fitted.
Gotcha.
There are some of the, like the wavy flares that, you know, which is that kind of S curved flare. I've spent upwards of 16 hours just on getting that riser fitted and put together properly. You know, there's a couple of those that I've lost my ass on because it's been, you know, like the woods that they used were just so hard and it took me so long to get that fitted properly that, you know, it, yeah, I lost my butt on that. But outside of that, like I said, normal hands-on time is about 7 to 8 hours. You know, it goes pretty quick. I mean, I get about an hour of grinding lambs. I grind 90% of my own veneers, you know, core woods. And then on, like, I'm not going to say it's not as tough as, you know, most people think it is, but it, if you have an eye and attention to, you know, an eye for detail and the attention to detail and kind of know what you're looking at, and what is aesthetically pleasing, it can go pretty quick. There's a lot of boyers that still use, you know, rasps and files to profile and shape the risers and whatnot. I use a band file, you know, half by 18 powered sander, and I do all my sanding with that, or all my shaping with that. I shape my tips with that. I can radius the shelf, radius the sight window. It's a super tool that allows me to shave a ton of time off and not have to worry about it. You know, once you get used to using it, it can hog off a bunch of meat in a hurry, but once you get used to using it, you kind of know how much pressure you need.
Yeah. What is that thing called again?
A band file.
Okay.
You can pick them up at Harbor Freight for about $30. They've got an electric one that's like $30 or $35. My first one I bought at Harbor Freight, that lasted me about 2 years. And the last go around, when that one burned out, I went ahead and I put the money into a Dynafile.
Are those it's like a portable anyway. So it's basically,
there you go.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I've seen those at Harbor Freight. I keep saying I'm gonna get one of these days, but I never do though.
I tell you what, for shaping, these things are awesome.
Yeah, time is money, right?
Yep, and that's the way I look at it. You know, I've one of my friends. he kind of gave me at my first show back in 2019. He gave me some hard medicine, and it was a tough pill to swallow. But I was rushing to get stuff ready. I didn't pay I didn't put that extra attention to detail in that I know that I expect to myself. And I showed up with like 6 bows. And his booth was set up right next to mine. He actually owns one of the largest traditional archery shops in the country. And you know, I was like, you know, what do you think, Dale? And he's like, do you think that they're worth what I'm asking? And he said to me, he used to be a boyer. He said to me, he's like, look, I'm going to give you the same treatment that I got when I was in your shoes, you know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, whatever. And he took my bow and he picked it apart. He's like, it's not worth what you're asking for. And this is why, you know, you still see tool marks here. You see this here, that there, you know, whatever. And it's like, fix that stuff and maybe, you know. But one of the things is like, how much time you spend on your bows? At that point, I was spending 12 to 16 hours on a bow, hands-on time. And he's like, I never ground any of my own lambs. I just bought lambs because it saves me time, you know. So, but to me, in where I understood that the time is money deal, an hour of my time isn't worth $20 a set of lambs. So, because that's about the going rate, you know. And two of my longbows, I use 3 sets of red elm laminations. And then if they're veneered, then you got the 2 veneer laminations. Now, my newest longbow has 5 core laminations. You know, so if I did that, that's $100 right there that I'm sending out the door to somebody else to do my work for me. I can have 5 sets of laminations ground in 45 minutes. So time is, you know, time is money, but an hour of my time is also, you know, even if I say it's worth $50, it's $50 for my hour of time to grind my own laminations versus $100 to grind, you know, to buy five sets of lamination.
Yeah. But how much time does that file save you though?
Oh, that band file?
Yeah.
Probably an hour.
An hour's an hour, man.
Mm-hmm. You know, there is something to be said though. I mean, about the idea when you buy it from somebody else, you lose that accountability, right? So if you mess up that piece, you don't have to pay double for having to go back in and fix it. So there is a little bit of insurance when you outsource a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like you can buy parts for just about anything these days.
Yeah. Yeah. And some guys will build a blank for you and mail it to you and you can finish it from there. I don't think I'll ever do that, but I know that there was at least one other Boyer and sadly he passed away last year. Maybe it was 2 years ago. It was Chad Holm, Homemade Bows. He was a great guy. I guess I never had the opportunity to meet him, but he would actually, I don't know what his cost was, but he would offer, you know, for a price, you come out, stay with him for a weekend type deal and build your own bow. He'd teach you how to build a bow and work you through building the bow. And I thought that was kind of a cool deal.
Yeah, it's like these woodworking schools. You go build a chair or Windsor chair and like that.
Yeah, yep.
I like the idea of like ordering someone makes a blank and then you have to do all the other refinements to create kind of like a guitar kit almost.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, and I mean like a blank is, you know, you give me a riser and what you want for veneers or whatever, and then I put it in the form and then clean up the glue edges on it and send it off to you, and then you know you get to design. You know, take care of everything else. I'll go for it, Sarge.
So I only got one other question for you on this whole bow thing. So, you know, like in furniture world, we use all kinds of things to laminate wood. Now, do you have specific types of adhesives that you use for laminating bows?
Yes.
Okay. They are.
I use smooth on EA 40 epoxy. That's the kind of the gold standard in bow lamination epoxy. There is one other, I think it's called Huntsman, that you can get in the US that some guys use. It's a lot thinner. The guys actually have to roll it on. I apply everything with a putty knife. I just use disposable plastic putty knives, but anyway, it's thick. It goes in amber. It cures clear. It's got enough flexibility and rigidity that it just holds up. Like I said, it's kind of the gold standard. I don't know that you can, outside of Huntsman, I don't know that anybody else is making a bow laminating epoxy, at least in the US or in North America. I know guys overseas are using something else, but yeah. I mean, heck, talking about inflation prices and whatnot, inflation and prices in wood, my epoxy price has gone from, I was paying $160 for a gallon kit, you know, so I get 1 gallon of part A and 1 gallon of part B, $160 for a kit of that 2 years ago, I think I was told that the new price is going to be 2.25 for this coming year. So
yeah, the reason why I was asked about that epoxy, because you know, I'm sure it's specific for that business because it has that flexibility without actually like breaking or cracking or whatever.
Right.
It has stretch. I was thinking about it. It's for laminating particular furniture that requires some kind of bounce or spring in it, like a laminated wood, seat structures and things like that. Laminating that, and so yeah. You know, it has some spring. Okay. I have to look into that.
Shut up, Sarge. You're just trying to make a new hip with a little extra bounce and spring.
No, I'll hook you up with the details on it. I mean, you can get it in as small as pint kits, and the pint kits were less than $50. You know, a gallon kit gets me probably 25, 30 bows. So,
yeah, I just bought some super clear, two, three months ago. And I didn't even buy the big gallon kit. I just bought comes in like 2 half-gallon bottles. Mm-hmm. That was like almost $100 to buy itself. I was like, man, this is how these people make any money making all this epoxy stuff. This shit's expensive, man. Because I look at what people are selling this stuff.
Well, so This is a future riser block, resin and epoxy, Buckeye Burl. This one, just this block cost me 200 and I think it was 220. Awesome. 20. I mean, like, that's how the guys are making their money. I mean, the stuff's not cheap, but, you know, it's passed on to your customer, you know?
Yeah, yep. Right.
I can make that for you if you want.
There you go, Wade.
For $250.
You seriously, right? Wade, that's a good idea. You could get some guys and start making riser blocks, man. There's a demand for riser blocks, right?
It's all how you sell it, man. You can make fucking pen blanks, riser blocks.
Yeah, well, and, you know, you see a lot of the pen blanks and stuff, but the getting pieces that big is kind of a pain. You don't find them very often, but the guy that I've been going through, you know, he's a traditional guy and he's buddies with
I can make
lawyer.
Them as big as you want.
Oh, baby.
that's what she said.
Didn't mean to interrupt.
But it, you know, so he's kind of got the corner on the market right now as far as the resin blocks go.
Does he vacuum them also, like put them in a vacuum chamber? Yeah. Okay.
Yep. Yeah. Cool. The wood's all stabilized and then the pour. And
it's a process right there. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is actually, the bow I made for my wife was from one of his riser blocks.
Got to stabilize and all that.
You
want them to be
struck
down.
Yep.
David, we really appreciate you coming on the show. We're coming toward the end, and that was part of our big things. Last year, we had some shows that were almost 3 hours.
And the older Sarge gets, the earlier he has to go to bed. So,
no. But, I got a question for you, real quick. Do you use any beard product? Or
yes, I do.
Okay,
well, yeah, that's a good one, Dwayne. Because look at that beard, man. That's pretty good, man.
I like these answers. Yes.
No.
Yeah, looking at the six of us, it's like one of these things just doesn't belong here.
I tell you what, when I got out of the military, and actually even before I got out of the military, it was when I left one company that wouldn't allow me to have beards. It wouldn't allow beards, and I went and worked for another company that didn't care. I would go month to month without shaving, and then once I got out of the military, I was sick of the damn razor, and I just let it go. I use Beard Baron products typically. I do have a friend that makes some as well, Chasing Heartwood. She's a sweetheart, but yeah, Beard Baron's oils and balms and butters have been just amazing for my beard. And then, you know, boar hair brush, and that's how I keep it in shape.
Is she a veteran by chance?
No, Kobe is not. She is a cool show, actually. She is a cowgirl through and through. I tell you what, like between making the beard oils, she used to make her own wool. Kind of got out of that and just doing more of the, she makes a lot of fleece products, hats, bow socks, that kind of deal. But she's big into the traditional community and makes her own soaps, that whole nine yards now. So, but anyway, she's awesome. I mean, that doesn't fall into the military maker category, but.
Oh, good.
Well, yeah, but we almost all have beards, so it falls in my category of I care.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Chasing Heartwood, tell her I sent you.
Definitely. Like Sarge said, appreciate you having you on the show, man.
Yeah, it was great being on. It was, like I said, I know Sarge kind of made the joke about it, and this was the first non-bow hunting podcast that I was going to do. But I mean, it was kind of refreshing because everything I've done has been very, you know, hunting related and getting down into the deep rabbit holes of that kind of stuff. And so it was fun. It was nice to do something a little bit different.
Oh, yeah. What do you mind sharing what podcasts those were? Cause I would love to hear your perspective on that stuff.
I've been on Primitive Pursuit podcast, Traditional Outdoors podcast, Green Mountain Tradcast. I should know that better. those three, Bear Bow Hunter podcast. I actually did that one while I was on shift at the station. And that one got cut short. I had to take a call. Painted Arrow Outdoors.
Man, very nice.
Quite a lot, yeah.
Yeah, I think I've been on Primitive Pursuit, I think 3 or 4 times now. So
one of our goals for this second season was to try to seek out some veteran makers with a little bit of different specialties, whatever you want to call it, than we've had on in the past. So you certainly fit that bill. And being a being an outdoorsman, deer hunter myself, I was looking forward to this episode. And I honestly had no idea you were prior crash fire rescue. So that's awesome, man.
Yeah, like I said, in it, not to say like it just without having hardware on the tarmac, man, it just it was kind of life sucking. You'd sat around, didn't do anything, drill weekends, and it versus coming from the weapons loading perspective where we jobbed every day, you know, like we got in at, you know, 6:30 and you had to go out, you had to load aircraft, launch aircraft, recover aircraft, you know, clean out, reload, launch, yeah. You know, yeah. And I just those the differences between that dichotomy was just too big for me. And yeah. I think that there was a large change in the Air Force structure in that, you know, 5 years when I did as well. And I think that just kind of all played a factor into it wasn't meant to be for me to get my 20, which sucks because
could have gone Space Force.
Yeah, I guess I should have.
Yeah,
you know, it's funny because I had got buddies that, you know, they end up going to desk jobs and I just couldn't go to a desk job. And yeah. There was so much about it that things I may have done different. I you know, looking back, should I have gone over to Selfridge? Probably. But, you know, I was with the grade A-10 unit and it just sucked to see it go away.
Yeah. These guys know I just retired in 2020 out of an A-10 unit myself down at Whiteman in Missouri. Yep. So,
yeah. Yeah. And they were a great unit. Yeah. You know, I was with the 110th and, you know, we were one of the premier, you know, and that's why the BRAC kind of hit us so hard is that, you know, we were one of the most highly decorated A-10 units in the whole Air Force. And, the A-10 that the A-10 that was recovered flew back after being hit by the SAM in Iraq by the killer chick, call sign KC. Anyway, that it was one of my crew chiefs that, you know, was crew on that aircraft and, you know, our load crews that were there. And anyway, yeah, it sucked to see that all go. And it was what it was.
Yeah. It was nice having you on, man. Thank you for your service.
Hey, thank you guys for your service as well. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
So David, sure. If anybody wants to get hold of you or, you know, see you about getting a bow and things like that, where are they going to find all this information and find you at?
They can find me on Facebook, Kalamazoo Bow Works, Instagram, Kalamazoo Bow Works. I've got a webpage. Poorly maintained. I'm terrible about the webpage, but it's kzubowworks.com. kzubowworks@yahoo.com if you want to get a hold of me via email. And my phone number is 269-303-6630 if you just want to give me a holler and talk to me about bows. So
don't give Sarge your phone number. That's the first rule of this podcast.
Can we edit that out before Sarge gets it?
Yeah, it's 555-55
867-5309.
That's right.
Hey, this is Sarge.
Hey, you want to be my friend?
No, I'm pretty open about it. You know, if you want to talk bows or want to order a bow, give me a holler. And you know, it's just hell. You don't have to buy a bow from me. I'll just give you I'll point you in the right direction.
I just saw Sarge add you to his quick dial there. Yeah.
I have an offline question for you, Dave. So don't go anywhere as soon as we hit order.
Okay.
All right. Well, that ends this one, and we really appreciate everybody listening to the show. And once again, we'd like to thank our Patreons, our patrons out there who joined the club and donate a little money every month to us. And if you want to be part of that, go to patreon.com/militarymakers. Or if you can't do that, please tell somebody about our show and tell them to listen to it and visit our Instagram page and all that stuff like that. Leave some comments, send us some questions on email. It's all the links are in our bio. So other than that, thanks a lot. You guys are awesome. Thanks.
Peace.
Peace in your butt grease.
Man, I hope that's not going to be permanent.
That's my call sign for closing. I don't know.
No sweat. 2 miles. 2 miles. Better yet. 3 miles.